note before I begin. You have on your first page the list of 8 lectures, and then the bibliography for this is already in this book. I hope. Do you have this one? The one that you, yeah, but you have the MST one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Does it have Hinduism too?
It has a reading list for Hinduism. I don't know if it's the same.
Yeah, maybe you. I could make a copy of this and give it to you. And then in addition to these lists, I mean, this contains both primary sources as well as secondary sources, that is the English books written by modern authors, both, yeah, I can make a copy of this one, then give it to you. And then in addition to that, I'll be from time to time supply in the handout any books that I refer. So the details of those books would be like, as you see in the notes, page 2. If you turn the page, you'll see 2 books that I've listed there for today's topic. So you could consult those. Other than that, we can start talking about bhakti. So this series of lectures are mainly dealing with bhakti from north to the south, and look at in a kind of comprehensive way to see not only the history of bhakti but also some theoretical issues related to how bhakti is defined, some of which I will raise now in this talk, but we will continue to unpack them through the, you know, various examples of these people that we have on the list. First of all, let me draw your attention to a couple of things. That is, from north to the south, you primarily come across the 2 types of bhakti tradition that are identified by scholars as saguna bhakti. I think it's the words are in the text here. There are 2 spellings, and sometimes they use saguni bhakti. And also saguna. And the same nirguna. So for those of you who don't have either any Indian vernacular background or Sanskrit background, let me just briefly, you know, some of the through your vernacular. Saguna bhakti basically refers to the idea of devotion to a personal deity or god, and nirguna bhakti is the idea of impersonal, abstract kind of idea of that transcendental entity, reality, whatever, nameless, formless, all of those things. So we will talk about some of those in specific examples as we go along in the next few weeks. But for this purpose, for the lecture today, I'll just briefly contextualize what these are and then talk about more in the context of how we understand bhakti and define, both in historical sense and also in terms of its features and characteristics and so on. First of all, there are some general assumptions that are made about bhakti. One of the assumptions is that bhakti was some kind of a social reform kind of response to a particular historical context in the Indian cultural religious history. That's one assumption. We will talk about it as we go along and unpack some of those things. And the second assumption is that bhakti is, normally when one refers to bhakti, one instantly thinks of Vaishnava tradition, that is worship of Vishnu and its various forms. You could be thinking of Bengal Vaishnava tradition, or you could be thinking of the Tamil Vaishnava tradition and so on. And there are a number of North Indian Vaishnava sampradayas or traditions. So generally there is that assumption or a kind of an unconscious kind of assumption by, sometimes it's also by scholars, you know, they tend to kind of generalize things. What I found in these two readings that I have suggested here is a kind of a review of some of those things, assumptions. So we'll kind of go through point by point. First of all, Lorenzen, of course, he does assume that this is a social ideological response. You would have to contextualize this in the context of Marxist kind of reading of history in India, in Indian history textbooks and so on. So because Marxist ideology placed tremendous amount of emphasis on social change and class, caste kind of distinctions and you know, all of these things, so they have tended to read that class caste ideological shift in the context of bhakti religions, especially in the north, not so much in the south, but yeah. So Lorenzen takes, for instance, bhakti as a movement that provided a social ideology. So you can see where it's coming from. As I said, there are two streams of the bhakti tradition, Saguna or Nirguni. And in both cases, if you begin to assume that bhakti is a kind of a social response to a religious kind of phenomenon or history and so on, then the most fundamental idea, the key concept in the Indian social reality is the Varna system, Varna Ashrama Dharma, as it is known. So those of you who are disinterested in Sanskrit or vernaculars can forget about that word, but at least try and kind of remember just this brief word, Varna. And I prefer using that term as a kind of a technical term, because it's difficult to translate that term as caste in the context of India. But just understand that it is approximate to that kind of reality, you know, caste being a kind of a typical Portuguese kind of word. But it is something that is based on social kind of division. So the Saguna Bhakti tradition, that is the tradition that espoused a personified understanding of God, is probably the one that actually quite actively subscribed to the idea of Varna system. In other words, they kind of perpetuated a Brahmanical social order, or at least subscribed to that. Whether they were actually part of a higher Brahmanical order or coming from a lower Brahmanical status or non-Brahmanical caste groups, somehow they bought the idea, the ideology of caste or Varna system. So that's the one point. Conversely, the Nirguna Bhakti poets or writers of Nirguna or the devotees that followed the Nirguna path tended generally to kind of denounce the caste. Now, I think this is what generally gave the hint to the Marxist historians, the idea that, okay, this is actually a caste kind of social transformation kind of movement. Because on the one hand, you have one group subscribing to that system and the other group kind of denouncing it. So you have this kind of ideological kind of conflict. So within the context of Indian social or religious social kind of worldview, Varna system is an important one because it is highly hierarchical and everybody knew where they belonged in the context of ritual and so on. So you are either in it, in the hierarchy, or outside of it. Now, before I go to Sharma's book, let me make a couple of other points. Now, the Nirguna branch of the Bhakti tradition generally also is part of this renunciation kind of tradition. Those who renounced the world, those who kind of the sannyasa type of approach to the world. So they are renunciants, like the yogis, the munis, the monks, and so on. So part of their ideology is to kind of renounce the whole material kind of world, and part of that was also to renounce the social hierarchical structures. In other words, you kind of reject all of that, control system, basically. So you operate basically outside that system. So generally, if you watch these ascetic monks and so on in India or anywhere, they always are outside the main limits of a town or a city, and they live on their own. So in a way they're cutting themselves off from the mainstream society. So that's in a way radical rejection of the active politics, the society and its ideology and so on. But the Saguni group generally remained within the social order and worshipped and express their devotion within the society, within the context of temples, within the context of domestic rituals and so on. So that's the key phenomenon. And what Krishna Sharma, for those of you who don't know this person, it is she. Krishna, you might think it is he, but in this case, it is a she. So you can have the word Krishna for a female person in India too. So
not Krishna.
Well, you don't kind of lengthen it in vernaculars. You just say Krishna. So it's commonly referred to as Krishna. In Sanskrit, you would make that, vocalic lengthening. And differentiate it, then you would know what it is. But in vernacular, you don't do that, and especially in popular usage, you could use Krishni in a kind of, you do get that kind of form, but you also get Krishna Kumari, for instance, which is a very common South Indian name, where if you normally in India you don't split those names, but in the West when you write you split those names. Krishna then appears as the first name and Kumari appears as the last name. So it's kind of convoluted kind of way of writing names. Sharma argues about a couple of things. That is, first of all, that she tries to reject the idea that bhakti is a homogeneous phenomenon. Of course, she is not the first one to have said that. She is simply restating it in her thesis, basically. She wants to make some other points, but that's where she begins. So she takes that as a starting point, namely to suggest that it is misleading to think of bhakti as a homogeneous kind of, you know, sort of system, but rather as a multiplex phenomenon. And therefore she rejects the kind of a methodology that would use a monolithic approach to the study of bhakti. As I indicated earlier, the two branches, the saguna and the nirguna, indicate not only the just a simple preference for a personified god and a non-personified kind of entity, but there is a fundamental ideological shift underneath this. So that is the point that she is trying to get at. So she says that the tendency to treat bhakti as an antithesis of Advaita, I will say something about Advaita, is not useful. In other words, in Advaita philosophy, which is a kind of close proximity of the renunciant type of ideology, in other words, sannyasa kind of ideology, Advaita actively subscribes to the idea of denouncing, rejecting the material world. Fundamentally because of the idea that this abstract idea of Brahman is one and there is nothing other than Brahman. So the implication of that is that the material world, which is posited as part of a duality in relation to God, God and world, in the Advaita scheme, there isn't any such duality. And the implication of that is kind of a radical rejection of this material world. And with that comes this idea of renouncing everything. So it's a kind of a renunciation ideology versus affirming the world as real and be part of that reality and so on. So, yeah.
Doesn't it take on that tone, though, in kind of the later formulations of it, like from Shankara and then Ramanuja? Ramanuja is kind of responding to Shankara.
Mm.
And so it has that kind of that feel of being an antithesis.
Yeah. I mean, that's what she is actually addressing. I mean, one tends to take that as an antithesis. In other words, because A, bhakti was generally conceived as a kind of a Vaishnava engagement. B, it is conceived as a kind of a devotion to a personal god. Then it is seen as a kind of a response to this Advaita. A, Advaita somehow implicitly subscribed to Shaivite kind of persuasion in its kind of theistic form, and where Shankara comes in as a kind of a non-theistic, negation of all reality and so on, rejection of all that personification completely, and simply a kind of an abstract idea of Brahman. So it is seen as a kind of a response to that. And of course, chronologically.
Isn't that partly true, though?
Hmm?
Isn't that partly true, though?
No, not necessarily. And this is what she's saying, because as she unpacks, you will see that the Nirguna